Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Well, Matt, back in the studio again, and we are coming back to the minor prophets, as you said last time, not minor because they're, you know,
not important,
less important, but just that they are the shorter prophetic words. And today we are going to be working through the book of Hosea.
Yeah, man, it's an interesting one, isn't it?
It sure is. So this is Thrive Deeper, episode 158, mostly written in the form of Hebrew poetry. The name Hosea actually means salvation in Hebrew, which is interesting as we read through the story. That we'll hear from Hosea today. Yeah. Now, he was a contemporary of Isaiah and Micah, who we're also going to come to later in the Deeper podcast soon in our edition of Thrive. And these guys were also at the same time of the rule of the northern kingdom ruler of Jeroboam the second, who was probably one of the worst of the Israel kings, and lots of, well, from a worldly point of view, the nation was going amazingly well, you know, prosperity, you know.
Jeroboam had quite a long rule, so that was conducive to prosperity.
Yeah.
But there, you know, Hosea is, his ministry really takes place probably in the last year of Jeroboam the second, so it's Jeroboam the second.
Yes, correct.
After that, things really go awry, and in a sense, he's anticipating that as a prophet. He's a prophet that's going to essentially is predicting what is going to be the complete destruction. Yeah. of the northern kingdom of Israel.
Yeah.
So they're about 30 years away from complete disaster.
Yes.
You know, and in fact, in that 30 years, they're going to have six kings after Jeroboam. They're going to be six kings in a period of 30 years.
All assassinated, you know.
Well, there's a lot of assassinations in there. Man, it is carnage in that 30 years. Also, you've got Assyria who are expanding. There's about, during Hosea's time, about six different incursions of Assyria, and including the one that is going to destroy the northern kingdom of Israel. That's the same around the time when Samaria is destroyed. Samaria is the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. That's the story about Hezekiah and the Assyrians at the walls of Hezekiah, very famous story. That happened sort of around the same time. Now, Judah is going to survive those incursions of the Assyrians, but of course, Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, is, you know, they're going to be wiped out. Mm. Hosea is anticipating this and, in a sense, announcing not only that this is going to happen, not only why this is going to happen, but also casting hope beyond that.
Yes, yes.
As well, that this is, even that this disaster is not the end of the story.
Yeah.
It's not the end of the story.
Yeah. And of course, through all of this military build-up, you know, Israel is trying to find its protection, and we'll get to this around military alliances
creating
a greater problem rather than a solution, because they refuse to talk to God, to go to God. And of course, that's what Hosea is going to speak to as he goes through this.
Even through this book, he's saying, even now, turn back to God. As the prophets did, even Jeremiah the prophet, right up to the destruction of the southern kingdom sometime later. You know, these prophets, they prophesied doom, but all along the way, even now, turn back. You know,
it's never too late.
The interesting thing about Hosea, though, Stu, and about this book, is the way that this happens.
Yeah.
Poor old Hosea. As I read this, I thought you would, and this is the impression I got reading again through the book of Jeremiah when we redid the edition of Thrive on Jeremiah, which is coming up at some point. As I worked through Jeremiah, I thought, you would not have wanted to have been a prophet. Like, who, you know, this, no wonder Jonah ran in the opposite direction. Like, you know, I mean, yeah, it's not a role. Mm. It wasn't a role to covet, this role of, being a prophet. Because, of course, in Hosea's case, God says to Hosea, go and marry,
Probably a temple prostitute, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah,
but
we don't,
certainly a promiscuous
that's right,
woman.
That's right. We and in the NIV translation says, go marry a promiscuous woman, have children with her, for like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. Mm. So Hosea, this prophet, is going to marry a woman probably who has a reputation for that. This is, remember, in this kind of society, this is going to cause a scandal. Okay, so this is going to get a lot of attention because Hosea, of course, is this godly prophet. And this godly prophet marries this promiscuous woman, probably someone that's well known for that. And if she was a temple prostitute, that's even worse. Now, we're not exactly sure what the situation was there. It's difficult to sort of guess, really. The point is that Hosea has to go through this heart-rending experience. Because he stands for God. He illustrates in his very life, he's going to embody the message of God that he's bringing to Israel. This is a message that Israel is like this woman who has broken covenant. You know, she's going to break. It could be even be preemptively that you know, God says, "I'm marry this woman," and she is going to, you know, and she, a woman who is going to be unfaithful to you.
Yes.
Because this is, you know, Hosea is going to experience on display for everyone, is going to experience the pain of what God has experienced.
Which is going to bring great weight to his message as he brings it to the people because, as you say, he's
it's going to get
feeling,
attention. Yeah.
And he's feeling the pain, you know, in a sense that God is feeling about his people who are betraying him as well.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right. The sort of metaphor of adultery is very common in the works of the prophets. That's that's how unfaithfulness to God is depicted because, of course, the covenant, God's covenant with Israel, probably the most common way of illustrating that covenant is being like a marriage. Marriage covenant.
Yeah.
It's why even actually often, you know, when we illustrate you know, what baptism is. Sometimes we use it. Well, it's like your baptism is like your wedding day.
Yes.
You know, it's not that you're not a Christian, not, you know, it's not the relationship's not there. It's just that you formalize it at baptism. And so, you know, baptism is like that covenant ceremony that, you know.
And we talk about the church being the bride of Christ.
Yeah, that's right. So in lots of different ways, you know, that's carried through. So, you know, so this idea of covenant unfaithfulness is often depicted in terms of you know, kind of spiritual adultery. I'll say something about the context too, because the big issue here actually mainly is Baal worship is the big issue here. There is the issue of the fact that Israel seemed to go everywhere else but to God for help. This is one of the key problems as well. They would go and they would make alliances with other nations and with the nations around them, you know, which in those cases of the nations in the immediate vicinity, they were told not to do.
Baal worship was, you know, largely a fertility kind of god worship.
So Baal was the god of the rains and the storms and essentially fertility. And actually was connected with cultic prostitution.
Yes.
So it was a kind of a sex cult, really, because it had to do with fertility.
Yes.
And these cults that had to do with fertility, that would often involve cult prostitution. So, you know, the head of the family, you know, was supposed to go up to the temple and engage in, you know, with the cult prostitute and pay for that. And so that would then sort of invoke Baal to essentially mirror the same thing and enable fertility of the crops and the animals and so forth.
Yeah.
So without getting into the gory details, that was kind of how it worked. So this is a very appropriate, this idea of marriage and the issue with Gomer and Gomer's
And just for listeners, the Baal worship, remember again, this was when the kingdoms had built, or Israel had built, a temple, a Baal temple in Bethany,
Yeah.
And in in Bethel. Yeah. And in where was
Bethel
it?
And Dan.
Dan, yeah, correct. Yeah. And so this, remember we talked about this in the Book of Kings,
yeah,
where they were going to these places, and this is in the midst of all of this happening and this Baal worship happening.
So when Jeroboam the First set up the calves at Bethel and Dan, that was at the north and the south, he did so to stop
people going to
the
Judah.
Israelites going down to Jerusalem. Mm. At that stage, you know, we set up calves. Now, calves were associated with Baal, directly associated with Baal worship. But it's not that Baal is the calf, but Baal was thought of as sort of riding on the backs of calves.
Right.
But the calves were seen as symbols of Baal's fertility. When Jeroboam the First set up those, that was meant to be a symbol of Yahweh. Let's just use the calf, and we'll make it a symbol. It's like, good on you, Jeroboam.
It's like the we know, yeah, at the bottom of Mount Sinai, isn't it? Really,
because, and again, you know, and I think in our context, we think, oh, it's so difficult to connect with this, right? What, like, why didn't they just stay faithful to God? Surely they knew that God is much more powerful than the Baals. What is this? What is this attraction to Baal worship? It's not even the fact that, you know, that the cults, you know, the cult itself involved the sexuality and there was sort of this alluring sort of cult associated with it. That may have been part of it. But the biggest reason is for a sense of security. If you're living in the ancient world, then you're sort of ingrained with this sense that your well-being is dependent on the local god who is going to make the land fertile. Because you are dependent for your life, right, on the crops and on the fertility of your herds, right?
Mm.
And so there's this strong sense, you know, there's this, well, yes, there's God.
But let's hedge our bets. Let's hedge our bets.
There's God, but there's the local god, Baal. Right. You really got to keep him happy, right?
Yeah.
And this, for them, this is real, right? That you know. And in some sense, you know, I think even now we would say, while we would certainly say Baal is not a god in the sense of God, you know, we could perhaps recognize some kind of sort of demonic spiritual entity behind all of that cult in some sense, you know what I mean? And so there's a real fear factor here with these, you know, as well. And there would have been a sense of that, you know, and so... This is why they would want to tick that box as well. Yeah. Just keep, yes, God, and all the evidence, you know, suggests that they were still quite religious in terms of, you know, giving at least lip service to Yahweh, to the, you know, God of Israel. Mm. But a lot of the energy and a lot of the sort of sacrifice went towards keeping the Baals
and
happy.
Yeah, and lest we think, oh, well, that's them and that history. You know, I think today we have different equivalents to Baal and where we don't depend on God, you know, money particularly is a huge driver. Where are we really going to trust God, or we're going to kind of pray, but at the same time we're going to put all this stuff in place to make sure, you know. So I think it's you're absolutely right. It's easy for us to look back and not relate to that and think, oh, that's just history. But in fact, in many ways, there are other gods that we have in the modern Western culture that take the place of God, you know.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
It's important to remember that.
In that particular area too, like, it's such a vulnerable, that little stretch of land, you know, along, you know, sort of west of the Jordan, and certainly east of the Jordan as well. It's a very vulnerable bit of land. If the rains don't, it really depends on the rains. Yeah. You know, you've got one water source, which is the lake up there, you know, the Sea of Galilee. And then you've got the Jordan run. I mean, you've got the Jordan down the middle. Yeah. And that's really your water source. And if, you know, if you've got drought, if there are no rains, it's also very hilly territory as well. So the sort of kind of irrigation from that the Egyptians did from the Nile isn't really possible there. You really need rain. You need the seasonal rains, and if they don't come, you'll starve to death. I mean, these are the sorts of issues here. So this is why, you know, they're just constantly falling into this Baal worship. Mm. However, you know, God had said to them in their covenant through Moses, I will provide you. I will provide for. I will ensure that you have what you need. Yeah. I will ensure that you know that you'll have your seasonal rains and you know fertility for your crop for your herds and flocks and so forth. So this really is a choice. And I know it's, it could be easy for us to say, oh, they're so stupid. Exactly. Why do they keep? But the pressure, I mean, this is life and death. I don't think even we really face in perhaps whatever our equivalents will be, even then for us, we still have safety nets.
Yes.
Like you can completely bottom out financially in our culture and there are still safety nets for you in that culture.
There was nothing.
If you bottom out, you and your family died. You know, so this is where this fear factor is. We've got to keep the bales, you know, it's a very polarizing sort of situation.
Yeah.
And so it, in a sense, it was a matter of who you had faith in though. You know, it's, what am I going to have faith in?
Exactly right.
You know, am I going to, I mean, even in our context, am I going to have faith in financial markets?
Yeah. Yeah, but that's what I was kind of saying. It's a bit like having a dollar each way. You know, it's like, well, I really do want to be able to trust God, but just in case, I'm going to also have this in place. And to some degree, as you say, this is where they were kind of lip service to Yahweh, but at the same time going, but let's just do this in case, you know, in terms of the bales and that kind of
stuff. And it's not like, you know, it's not like they were looking for manna from heaven, just to get the equivalent right, you know. And neither should we. We're not just looking for money to afford. You know, you've got to work and you've got to be wise and you're going to invest wisely. And, you know, all of that sort of stuff is completely legitimate. You know, we're not looking for matter to fall out. Neither were they, right? You know, they've still got to, you know, sow their crops and
harvest and
all of that sort of stuff, right? So they've got to do that. But it's this sense of where does your ultimate sense of assurance and security come from? And this is the big issue here. And
so essentially we're saying, or Hosea is saying that idolatry really is the equivalent of adultery in the context of this story of him and Gomer. And this is the picture he's painting actually in his life. It's like he's actually living this out. He's not just giving an illustration.
Yeah.
This is his life.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So he goes through this painful experience. He marries this woman. She has three kids. And then there's this terrible situation where she, you know, where she's unfaithful to him. And Hosea is then commanded to receive her back. In chapter 3, the Lord said to me, go show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another man and is an adulteress. Mm. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love and so forth.
Yep.
So I think it's worth pausing it because this is actually amazing, really. You know, it's like, yes, the Israelites are in this terrible situation, but God is saying, I still love them.
Yeah.
I still love them, you know. Yeah. You know, Ephesians, you know, 2, while we were yet sinners Christ died for us.
Yeah.
So he has to buy her, interestingly, he has to buy her back. Now, the reason for this may be because having left his household, she may well have fallen into some kind of slavery.
Yes.
Maybe the cult prostitutes, that was connected with slavery as well. They were probably slaves, essentially.
Yes.
Slaves to that system. And so it may be that she goes back to cult prostitution, if that's the case, and that he has to actually buy her back. He has to actually pay for her to come back.
Yeah.
So, which is a striking illustration when you think that actually for forgiveness to happen and reconciliation to happen, there has to be a price. There's a buying back that needs to happen, of course. Yeah. You know, that's what God did in Christ. So this is anticipating this. A lot of this book is anticipating what's going to happen beyond the disaster because this is prophetic of what God is going to do.
Yeah. So important again to note that Hosea at this point, he could have ended his covenant marriage to Gomer.
Well, she'd certainly broken the covenant.
He could have ended
that. Yeah, that's right.
So he had two options, either do that or to try to restore it. And he was commanded by God to restore it.
Yeah.
And again, there's a picture of God where he could have chosen you know, to end the covenant with the people, but he chooses
not
to.
But he's saying, that's right. Yeah. Now, this, of course, is pointing beyond here because there are lots of messages of hope throughout throughout these prophecies. But they are looking beyond what's going to happen in 722 BC. So 722 is the date when the Assyrians come in and completely destroy the northern kingdom and carry the people off into exile. Mm. They leave some people there, some survivors, but they resettle Assyrians there. So this is actually that event, that disastrous event that takes place within sort of around, you know, about 30 years from this point. That's pretty much it for this generation. That's going to be their experience. So it's not that God is promising actually to turn things around for this generation as such. It's going to happen, and this is sort of this multi-generational view. In fact, these prophecies essentially, you know, because it's like, well, when does Israel, the northern kingdom, when do they get gathered back? You know, like when did that happen? Because we know with the southern kingdom, they came back from exile in 537 BC. You know, Cyrus, the Persian king, after they conquer the Babylonians, you know, releases the Jews to go back to Jerusalem. Nothing of the kind happens with Israel, the northern kingdom. They're scattered. And presumably, because one of the reasons for this practice of exiling people is so that they just assimilate into basically more or less that's what happened. They assimilated into Assyria and just sort of disappeared essentially.
And Judah, of course, is now the Jew as we know them as the Jews.
They become the Jews. So that's going to be what's left in the south. Now Hosea is speaking primarily to the northern kingdom, who are about within, you know, in 30 years are going to be completely destroyed. Now he's saying to them, I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to forgive you. I'm going to, I'm going to, all of these things that happened to Hosea, I'm going to purchase you back. Mm. Right. Mm. But of course, he's not talking about them. This is in our individualistic way of thinking. It's all about what's in it for me personally.
Yeah.
But God is thinking multi-generationally. He's thinking about his people in a multi-generational, hundreds, thousands of years, right? God is thinking big picture when he's talking about my people. Yeah. So Gomer here, the woman that Hosea marries, she stands for God's people multi-generationally across potentially thousands of years.
Yeah.
So the question is, when does he purchase her? When does this purchasing back and this regathering in happen? Well, of course, it happens through in the acts of Jesus Christ, and then the ingathering of the nations after that time. That's really the ultimate fulfillment of that. Because in a sense there's and Revelation brings this out because Revelation lists the tribes of Israel and so forth
and even the pointing forward of that, and we'll probably get to this later. I'm just trying to quickly find my notes here where it's 2 days and then I will restore you on the third day. And it's just, you know, all this pointing forward to Christ, which is later in the book. Just before we move on from Gomer and Hosea and his family, and I guess we're going to move into the sort of indictments that he brings against the nation of Israel. Interesting, the names that he was commanded to give the children, you know, these are really strange names by anyone's standards. Obviously, they're translated into English here, but...
Yep. Don't get any ideas if you're having kids.
Yeah,
maybe not these names.
So the first son, Jezreel... we might remember that Jehu had carried out God's kind of judgment against the last of the Omri dynasty, and that took place at Jezreel.
Yeah.
But he probably overstepped the mark. And so here, Hosea's first child was a message to Israel that Jehu's dynasty was also not going to be escaping judgment for that. The daughter, who was the second child, was named Not Loved, let's just go with that. There's a few different ways. And again, this signifies that due to Israel's continual unfaithfulness, they'd forfeited God's love at this point in time.
Yeah.
And then Not My People. Again, Israel had utterly broken their covenant with the Lord, and so he was essentially, this is the option he had. Yeah. Well, you're no longer my people, you know, which obviously he doesn't do because, as you say, there's a message of hope that comes. But the way these kids are named... is as well a bit of a prophetic message too.
Yeah, that's right. And it's pointing to the broken covenant when it's not loved. It's in the formal sense.
Yes.
It's like you have broken the covenant.
Yeah.
So it's there's this gulf now.
Yes.
And that's got to be actually restored. Now, the way that, you know, the way that the status was at that point is that they, you know, there was complete alienation. And as we see, in the same way as Hosea had to reverse that with Gomer, God is going to reverse that with Israel. So the next big chunk, chapters 4, you know, pretty much right to 11, is, you know, and I think a key to reading oracles like this, because, you know, they can, sometimes you can read, oh, this is a bit tiresome, and what you've got to try to get from these is a sense of the heart of God, the heart of God. They're actually really unique. There's nothing really else like them amongst, amongst ancient Near Eastern literature, because this is a very personal relationship with a very personal God who really grieves over his people.
Yeah.
And so you really see here the heart of God mourning over his people. Mm-hmm. One of the key issues is that this lack of knowledge, this real lack of knowledge of God, you know, they're not even giving themselves the chance to know God. Another issue is hypocrisy. You know, they're giving lip service to God, but going off and worship them. But that's almost even worse. Yes. You know, it'd be better if it was just clear. Is also the issue of that they're trusting in political alliances with other nations, you know, which in this time of instability, you know.
Plus they weren't showing any love or compassion to the less fortunate or kindness to others, as we talked about in Amos.
Yeah.
Last time we spoke.
Right.
And I think important just on the knowledge, because you read that you do not know, you know, no knowledge of God. This is not intellectual knowledge. This is know as in relationship, know.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, where, you know, I do not know you or have not known you kind of thing. It's that know. It's that relational relationship not just knowing about God, but knowing God personally. So,
And then chapter 11, you have a real prodigal son.
Yeah.
A real prodigal son theme in chapter 11.
Yeah.
Where, you know, God is depicted as the loving father. You know, I taught you to walk. I loved you. You were my son, but, you know, you rebelled against me. You have this sense of Israel as this son that's just been loved and taught and equipped and, you know, and then leaves home, you know, just says, I'm out of here. And, you know, you have this expression of God's grief, you know, where ultimately he says, how can I give you up? I can't give you up, you know. And he keeps, by the way, this is important because this might be confusing to some people. Israel is mostly referred to, not only as Israel, but the other key term that used is Ephraim. Or Ephraim in Hebrew. The northern kingdom is often referred to as Ephraim, because that's the biggest of the northern tribes.
Yeah.
It's often also referred to as Jacob.
Yes.
So this is the confusing thing.
We've jumped to chapter 11. I'm sure we're going back a little bit, but he even references sort of the story of Jacob in terms of the restoration. Where Jacob had been faithless, self-centered, conniver. He met God at Bethel and was converted, and he became a recipient of grace.
Right.
You know,
that's right. That's in chapter 12, I think.
11
chapter
or 12. Let's just go back because we're jumping ahead a bit here. So after the indictment about, you know, no faithfulness, no truth or integrity, no love, compassion, kindness, no knowledge of God, he then gives the threefold kind of warning.
Yeah.
You know, essentially blow them away like a whirlwind, eat away at them like a moth or rot, and tear them to pieces like a lion, basically. Yeah. This is the warning that Hosea's giving here. And he even then refers to the major center at Bethel, which again is where the temple was or the altar was. He uses the term Beth Avon, which actually means house of wickedness. So he's kind of like pointing to all these things that are actually drawing them away from the true Yahweh, the true God of Israel. Yeah. So
it's interesting on that topic of, you know, Jacob and so forth. It's interesting the way that the prophets, they often, when they're talking, this is again the multi-generational thing, which is such an important perspective, that they will often say, you did this back when you did, it's like, when did we do I can't remember. Yeah. You know, they'll talk about back when you were in the desert, you know, with Moses. Like, this is hundreds of years before. And yet it's them, you know, yeah. There's a sense of this corporate
responsibility,
which is why, you know, in one sense, you know, there's this connection with the sins of their fathers. Not culpability as such, but this pattern that they are, in a sense, continuing with.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's still this sense that it's the one people, you know, and that's also goes into the future as well. You know, you did this, but I'm going to forgive you and I'm going to do this for you in the future. And actually, if you're someone living at that point,
you're waiting for it to happen, yeah, and it hasn't
yet. You know, you're not really going to sit, not in your lifetime, no, but and yet there's a genuine sense that this is good news because this people, you know, your descendants are going to, you know, are going to be gathered in,
yeah,
in some sense, you know, yeah, and restored back to God. So the history lessons are interesting. You know, it refers to Jacob's lying. The fact that, you know, Jacob, you know, there was restoration, you know,
yes,
there.
And exactly.
Through his, you know, his laying hold of God. Mm. It refers to Israel's rebellion in the desert, even refers to Israel's choice of a king in King Saul.
Yes.
You know, like, yeah. And this isn't just digging stuff up from the, this is because there's a
pattern.
Yeah. There's a pattern here because the choice of the King Saul is, no, we want the kind of security that the other nations have. And this is what's going, oh, it's like, what's that old thing again?
Yeah.
You know,
and we're going to do it our way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're that's right.
Rely on you.
Yeah. And so, but throughout this, you know, scattered throughout this again, and just to really underscore this, you've just got these oracles of hope. You know, I will heal their waywardness, chapter 14, and love that. You know, I mean, there's these constant reminders that God wants them to come back and be restored. Interesting verses, Stuart, and I'm just trying to find them here. About the, oh, death, where is your sting? I don't know if you pick this up. In Hosea chapter 13 and verse 14, Stu, there's just, and this is a detail, but it's an interesting one because yes. This is quoted from in 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul is talking about the resurrection. Mm. And the verses that he quotes are, where, O death, are your plagues? Where, O grave, is your destruction? Right.
Yeah.
Now, in the original context, there's a couple of translation issues because in Hebrew, whether something is a question or not can sometimes be
So
so the verses before that, start of verse 14, it says, I will deliver this people from the power of the grave. Mm. I will redeem them from death. Mm. And then it goes on, where, O death, your plagues, where, O grave, is your destruction. However, in the context, it suggests actually those are questions.
Should I?
The whole thing is a question.
Yeah.
So, should I deliver this people from the power of the grave? You know, should I redeem them from death?
Mm.
And then the where, O death, your plagues, and where, it's like, come on, bring it on. Where are you? Let's
right,
you know,
right.
That because in context, because it goes on to say, I will have no compassion, even though he throws.
Yeah,
it goes on seamlessly. So before, in verse 13, it says, pains as of a woman in childbirth come to him, but he is a child without wisdom. When the time arrives, he doesn't have the sense to come out of the womb. In a sense, it makes most sense to translate, should I deliver this people from the power of the grave, or will I deliver this people from the power of the grave? Will I redeem them from death? So there's an ambiguity here, which if that's the case, and then, you know, it's really interesting then what Paul does with that in the way that he actually deliberately then turns that around. And makes it that rhetorical question, where, O death, are your plagues? Yeah. Where, O, you know, where is your destruction?
Mm.
Because Jesus has held that off. Jesus is in a sense, held off the power of death, as it were.
Yeah. Wow.
So, you know, it's interesting, just a little footnote there. But however, it is ambiguous, and certainly the NIV translates it in the positive rather than the negative. But I just noticed most of the commentary material was leaning towards this interpreting this question in the negative. But certainly the big picture here is that God is promising hope beyond this disaster.
In chapter 14, we see, there's the promise of restoration, which, Hosea brings.
Right to the end. And I think, this is always this so consistently. And when you're reading these books, one of the best questions to ask is, what does this say about God? What does this book show me about God? Reading the works of the prophets, one of the best things that I've got is a sense of the heart of God in all of this. You know, that one of the big issues here is that they didn't really know God, not in that deep relational sense. Well, these books are written that you would know God, that you would know the heart of God, that you would know that even no matter how entrenched you are, no matter how lost you feel, no matter how much of a failure you feel, God does not give up. You know, as he says, how can I give you up, Ephraim? He says, how can I give you? It's, think of the prodigal son references, and connect that with what Jesus says to his generation, that absolutely, even now God is willing to, to receive you back and read this and get a real sense of how much God yearns for us, how much God's heart is for restoration. It's always for restoration. God's heart is for restoration, and how inexhaustible is the grace of God.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.